KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum on this Veterans Day, we discuss the role of women in the military and the difficulties faced by women veterans, especially now that more women have experienced combat situations in Iraq, despite policies that technically prohibit them from being in combat. We'll have a panel and we'll take your calls and emails up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum and welcome to our Veterans Day Hour on Forum. The Department of Defense policy bans women from direct ground combat. But as we learn in a soon-to-be broadcast documentary called Lioness, which airs this Thursday on KQED TV at 10:30, women serve on the battlefield and have seen direct combat in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And according to the filmmakers of Lioness, quote, "Fuzzy front lines and guerrilla tactics have thrust more women soldiers into enemy fire than ever before," end of quote. Women returning from the military suffer many of the same challenges and difficulties as men in the military, but without proportional services. In this Forum Hour and on this Veterans Day, we want to turn our attention to women veterans and women in the military. But really, what I want to do is first reference a couple of articles or stories that appeared, I should say, in this morning's San Francisco Chronicle regarding the fact that there are 2,000 veterans that are now homeless on the streets of San Francisco. And the VA has had a real problem, taking up to 4 years, in fact, in some cases, to pay disability claims. Thursday, I emceed the annual Veterans Organization Swords to Plowshares Profiles and Courage Awards at Moscone Center West in San Francisco, and certainly got a good picture, as I know many of you have had who know about that organization, of how difficult it is for veterans. And we want to focus on women this hour, but we have Tia Christopher from Swords to Plowshares with us. She's Women's Veteran Coordinator. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also with us in studio this morning is Lindsay Rousseau Burnett, who is a former sergeant in the U.S. Army and one of the filmmakers of a veteran who's joining us here in studio. I was trying to make you a filmmaker, and you're not. You're just...
That's okay. I'll take the promotion.
Well, thank you. And thank you both for your service, by the way. And the same to our guest who's joining us from New York, Meg McLagan, who is the filmmaker who did Lioness, which is a film about the experiences of female soldiers in Iraq that airs, as I said, this Thursday night at 10:30 on KQED television. Welcome, Meg McLagan.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. And again, let me say on this Veterans Day, a special thanks to all of those who have given or are continuing to give service to this country, regardless of what your politics are out there. I think you can agree with the sentiments and certainly hope that you indeed do. Let me begin, Tia Christopher, with you, if I may. And let's begin by talking about, well, women veterans and what makes their what makes for the difference in terms of women coming back. I want to talk about women in combat because that's a big issue, but they still, in people's minds, aren't even seen as soldiers in many instances. That's kind of one of the big problems, isn't it?
Yes.
So let's talk about when they come back, because they come back with post-traumatic stress syndrome. They come back with problems related to sexual harassment and sexual abuse, molestation, rape, all of these kinds of things that men veterans don't have, and yet not viewed as soldiers.
No, I think... as a society, we're still not ready to see women as soldiers. And this particular new cohort of women who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, many are coming back with combat trauma, some with sexual trauma, some with both. And this is a new cohort that, as a society and clinicians also, are not prepared for and may have never dealt with. And
the VA is not ready for this either. As I said in my introductory remarks, 4 years, there's a class action suit, in fact, which was thrown out, about 60,000 vets.
Right.
But it's hard to get data where women are concerned, isn't it?
Well, part of the reason is there hasn't really been many studies that have compared the women veteran population with the civilian population. So to compare rates of PTSD with that of the civilians and that in the veteran sector. Also, there's differing definitions for combat. So if you say, okay, women aren't in combat, well, what is combat? So officially, no, women aren't in combat, except as we're seeing and as we're all very well aware, women are definitely in combat. And you can see that in the film Lioness. However, there's different definitions of what combat is. Combat is, you know, kicking in doors, or is combat being on a FOB in Iraq, being mortared? What is combat? So if we're going to do more research and studies to back up the need for more services, we need some more standardized definitions.
Well, they're not in the infantry, but they're out there, and they're out there in ways that certainly present harm to them on a constant basis. And the fact is they're not prepared.
Right, because technically they're, quote-unquote, not in combat. So they may not be completely schooled in the different weapons, the routes, the different skills that they would need to occupy those roles, because technically women are still in support roles. However, you have a water treatment specialist going on clearing missions who now has some really brutal combat experience and PTSD from that experience.
We don't know the number of women with PTSD, but I saw some figures which were alarming. 20% of combat veterans who are women say they endured some kind of sexual assault. The VA reports 22% have had some kind of military sexual trauma. And those are pretty startling numbers.
Well, in just 2006 alone, of the 27,000 new patients the VA saw for PTSD that were diagnosed with PTSD, 3,800 of them were women.
And right now, as I said, we've got 2,000 homeless vets here in San Francisco. There are 260 programs for homeless vets in the National Coalition for Homeless Vets, but only 8 special programs for women, though we've got 15% of the military being women.
The fastest growing cohort in the homeless population is women veterans.
Well, what do you want to see happen? I mean, I guess hopeful with this new administration?
Definitely hopeful with this new administration. Honestly, as a women veteran, I'm just still waiting for not only myself, but for my peers that are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan to have equality in healthcare, equality in services. As working with my clients at Swords to Plowshares, I have young women or their parents call me and say, please, you know, I need treatment for substance abuse, or I need, I'm going to be homeless. And I spend hours and hours and hours trying to find a place to put them. And sometimes I go home not having found services. And mind you, I'm good at my job and Swords to Plowshares is awesome. But sometimes there just isn't anything for these women. And how do you tell somebody or their parents, I'm sorry, but even though you're saying you need help, and sometimes us vets, it's really hard to admit that we do need help, but to actually tell them, I'm sorry, but I can't help you. And so I work every day to make so that I don't have to say that.
Tia Christopher is the Women's Veteran Coordinator for Swords to Plowshares. I'm going to go to New York and bring Meg McLagan into this discussion. She's a filmmaker who made Lioness, a co-producer and director of a film about the experiences of female soldiers in Iraq, which, as I said, airs this Thursday on KQED-TV. And a lot of this film, as you've said, your intention, Meg McLagan, was really to start a conversation not only about the role women play vis-a-vis combat, but also, well, questions of mental health and the help that women are simply not getting.
Yes, we were very interested to bring to the attention of the larger public what women are doing in Iraq, and to see if we could help facilitate a conversation about what they're doing so that when they come back, what they're doing in Iraq so that when they come back, we know how to take better care of them. Because if you don't know that they have been doing missions that takes them into direct ground combat, you know, they have to be treated as combatants when they come back, and they need services that are tailored for them that are gender specific.
Well, there is a policy, 1994 policy, that bans women from direct ground combat, and I thought actually we'll get into this issue some more, obviously, but I'd like us to hear a cut from your film, and let's hear it.
Really, it was not an ideal situation to have the Lioness team out there, because now we had transitioned from kind of a benign search operation into semi-urban combat.
captain of the Marine SOS and realized, oh, crap, these females have been out here in the firefight. And he's like, get in the truck. And Shannon and I are kind of like, well, where's our vehicles?
I didn't want the responsibility of having a female soldier attached to me killed during this operation.
When we were out in the firefight, there was a tow missile on top of the Humvee. And I asked the soldier, well, how the heck do I fire that thing if one of you gets hurt? Because I would like to know how to fire the biggest weapon we've got. I felt we needed to know more.
They were engaging in combat before the Army was giving that kind of training to the combat support troops from which they were drawn. So it was even more dangerous for them because they were going in with very little training.
Well, that's a cut from the film Lioness. Meg McLagan, who is the filmmaker, is with us. First of all, tell us about Lioness itself.
The
outfit.
It was really this under the radar program that was created by this Army battalion, engineering battalion, in response to the need to reduce violence that people were encountering American male soldiers when they were going on raids and at checkpoints and in places in Ramadi. They realized that by having women soldiers with them, they could respect the Muslim restrictions on male-female interaction. And so they started to take the women out with them in pairs and on these missions. And
that's involved like searching Muslim women and that sort of thing.
Searching Iraqi women, and if they were going into a home, they would stay with them and basically handling the women and children so that you know, because it would create a lot of tension if the unrelated American males got involved with searching and touching Iraqi women.
And these women were exposed to essentially what the men were exposed to vis-a-vis combat.
Yes, they were. I mean, the thing that clip really shows is this group was one of the first in. They went in the fall of 2003, and they really did not understand, I think, the cultural impact at the time. And so then they devised this program sort of on the ground to try to address this need. And then what you hear people talking about is you sense the confusion on the ground. The Marine commanders understand that they're really not supposed to have women out running around in a firefight. That's why they're telling Rainey to get back in the truck. And, you know, what began as one sort of mission clearly evolved into a full-scale, full-blown firefight where they're all out running around and engaged in direct ground combat. And so there's this kind of slippery slope that happens, and you sense that confusion, and you sense the kind of gray zone that the women end up in because it's not really clear where they should be, what they should be doing, and you know, the male commanders don't want to have to be responsible for having these women killed on their watch. It would be a problem. So that's what you hear the male commanders, kind of one of them giving voice to that concern.
Well, we'll talk to Rainey shortly, but that kind of concern, well, for example, I was reading directives put out by the Center for Military Readiness. Also, I should mention, I was reading a Pentagon spokeswoman, Eileen Lanes, who says there's no gap between policy and reality, which I'm sure you and many of the women who were with us this morning would take serious exception to. But you read statements by the Center for Military Readiness, and they say this is all about American cultural values, to stave off violence against women, that good men respect and defend women, that women are mothers, that women are pregnant, and therefore they have to be kept out of harm's way. But the irony, I suppose, that one realizes from watching your film is they're not out of harm's way. No. And they need to be prepared.
Yes. Yes. You can't ask women to go over and do these jobs and not have them be trained. And they, at this point, they don't get... They get some training, they get basic training, and they get an additional two weeks of combat training, which is a result of some of the lessons that have been learned in the last 3 years since the events took place in this film. But basically, they really need to, you know, they can't get all the combat training that they might get otherwise because the policy prevents them from being in combat units. And so they need to I think, examine that policy. And then when women are in this situation, they will have the same kind of training that the other folks are getting, the male troops are getting.
Again, Meg McLagan with us from New York is filmmaker who is responsible for the film Lioness, which will be seen on KQET TV this Thursday, 10:30 p.m. Lindsay Rousseau-Burnett is with us in studio, former sergeant in the U.S. Army. And you didn't get the training. You had to kind of do it on your own, didn't you?
Yeah, that's very true. And I'd actually like to say up front that I think this is also the case for many of the support units that are in the military. Because of the transformation of the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan, support troops in general are not prepared for these types of fights. However, women tend to be less prepared, I believe, because they are, you know, only relegated to those troops. So when I was sent to my unit, it was after Donald Rumsfeld decided to do what we call the transformation of the U.S. Army, where all the units were converted into what's called a brigade combat team, where for the first time you're creating what's supposed to be a self-sustaining unit with infantry troops, artillery troops, engineer troops, support troops. And so I was one of the first women in my unit. And because of my job as a journalist and a photographer and a videographer, it was my job and my duty to be out with all these different types of troops, documenting, photographing and taking video. And, you know, I kind of took it upon myself to because I was with the infantry most of the time, I realized that in order to fully understand what they were doing, I had to understand their tactics, their weapons. And so I kind of was lucky in that I was able to make friends with some of the soldiers and some of the commanders and have them kind of show me the ropes, which was necessary to do my job and make sure I wasn't going to get in their way when things happened. But that also I knew what they were doing. So I knew where to go to get the best pictures.
But you were in a couple of situations. I mean, you left the base in a vehicle and it was hit by an IED. As I understand it, you couldn't go with the infantry units on midnight raids against insurgents, even though you wanted to. So there were limitations that were imposed upon you.
Absolutely. I think the main thing is that you have defensive missions and you have offensive missions. Defensive missions are your transports, you know, your civil affairs missions going out to interact with the population, which, you know, at any time you can be attacked. Your offensive missions are when you have, you know, a combat unit, an infantry unit making plans based on intelligence to go into a certain area to find an individual. And I was able to go on some of those, but the ones that were considered incredibly high risk, I was not allowed to go because of safety concerns, because I wasn't part of the team, and also because I was female and I could potentially be a distraction should something happen.
Yeah, the arguments you hear have to do with that, at least one of the arguments. Discipline and unit cohesion is affected by gender integration. I think that's the official kind of language. I'd like to get your response to that. But the bigger issue that seems to keep coming up is that women can't carry the physical load in the same way that men can. You're talking about 50 to 100 pounds in some instances. So you hear that there's less body strength, there's less aerobic capacity, therefore there's less ability to and more stress on bones and causes for fracture and all that sort of thing. So that you hear those arguments, and you also hear an argument that if you want equal training, it's going to have to gear down for women because they can't carry as much, so forth.
Yeah. I can't swear on the air, but I can say that that's absolutely not true. In my job, I actually carried more weight than your average infantry soldier. About the only person who carried more weight than me was your submachine gunner, and that's because he had to carry two weapons. But with my camera equipment, my M4 rifle, which I had to carry an M4 rifle, all of my body armor, I was carrying about 70 to 75 pounds on a daily basis. That's not including the other equipment I take with me, such as computers. And so from that standpoint, it's absolutely untrue. You know, I was actually, had comments from infantry commanders saying, wow, you're doing better than some of our soldiers are because, you know, with the lowering standards, you do have soldiers who are overweight, who are, you know, I had one soldier, he was barely 5 foot. So to think that he could fireman carry someone out of, a hostile attack was absolutely absurd. But I do not believe standards should be lowered. I absolutely disagree with that. And when the Army overall lowered their standards about 2 years ago, I thought that was just, you know, absurd. absurd. And, you know, there are soldiers, because we're so desperate to send people over to Iraq and Afghanistan, we're just forgetting about the physical qualities. We're sending people who are injured, who are overweight, who are mentally unstable. And, you know, there are women out there who can do what the men do. And there's also men out there who absolutely can't do what their fellow male soldiers are doing.
Lindsay Rousseau-Burnett here with us in studio as a former sergeant in the U.S. Army. And we wanted to bring Rainey Ruthig on, who was mentioned earlier, who is also a former staff sergeant. She's now an NCO, highest enlisted rank with the Kansas Army National Guard in the U.S. Army, and is with us from South Dakota, which is her home base. She was part of the Lioness Unit. And you're from South Dakota, but you're in Kansas this morning. Rainey Ruthig, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you had a lot of, I mean, you were shot at, you had grenades thrown at you. How do you weigh in on this whole issue?
Well, listening to everybody, and I agree, my experiences in the active duty, I had over 12 years in before I got out and joined the Kansas Guard, and I had female soldiers that could out-PT male standards on a PT test, and I had male soldiers who couldn't pass a sit-up. I mean, for the combat support, females aren't getting the training, but the males in the combat support units also aren't getting the trainings. And for anybody at any time in Iraq can become in a firefight and be engaged in combat.
Well, I'd like our listeners to hear a cut from the film that involves you and then get you to comment on it.
The first mission I ever remember going on was middle of the night. We did most of our missions anywhere from 11 to 5 in the morning. It was all based off intel that people were hiding weapons. They wouldn't let us in the house, so we ended up having to bust down the doors. We roll into the house, and we were at the last of what they called the stack. You know, men went in, secured the area. We came in behind them. We usually guarded the interpreter because the interpreters over there weren't armed. The women and children are all in one room. The men are all in the other. The women and children, they were just panic-stricken because, you know, we were supposed to search them. And finally, Morgan and I took off our helmets. And once they saw we were females, they started trying to talk to us.
Well, that's a direct narrative from your experience. And we're talking about also being in harm's way. I mean, you've served a specific purpose, but you were out there and you were pretty exposed and vulnerable.
Right, but the missions that they sent us off never started off thinking that it was going to become a dangerous situation. We were going house to house for intel searches. They realized that the Iraqi women were being handed important paperwork and documents that the men didn't want to have found, and the need for us came because, you know, we couldn't the male soldiers couldn't touch the females over there.
Rainey Ruthig, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you being with us here on Forum this morning. And again, Rainey Ruthig is a former staff sergeant, now an NCO in the Kansas Army National Guard, and is featured in the movie Lioness, which we're talking about with the filmmaker, as well as a couple of veteran women who are with us this morning, Lindsay Rousseau-Burnett, a former sergeant in the U.S. Army, and Tia Christopher, Women's Veterans Coordinator for Swords to Plowshares. Your calls are welcome on this Veterans Day, the whole issue of women in combat, but also women needing services and vets needing services, of course, across the board, but women having some special needs and sort of not being recognized as soldiers. If you'd like to weigh in here, please do. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, join us now, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email. Email address is forum@kqed.org. When we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and this is Veterans Day, and we're talking this hour about women veterans, and particularly the role of women in combat. They're serving, of course, in many roles in the military, but serving also on the battlefield. Women in Iraq have seen direct combat, despite the fact that there is ongoing controversy with respect to Pentagon policy that actually prohibits them from being in combat. A couple of interesting statistics here. Only really about 10 to 15% of women support involuntary combat assignments on the same basis as men. And there are more female promotions in the military now than there are male promotions. But the Center for Strategic and International Studies did a poll, and they asked women, well, male and female respondents, about female personnel and to what extent they would pull their share in combat or hazardous situations. And 36%, now this is men and women, said they felt that they would be able or up to the task of, again, pulling their share is the phrase. But we're hearing certainly from some women veterans here who are giving a very different picture than what those kinds of numbers might indeed incline one to think. We're talking, in fact, with Tia Christopher here in studio, who is Women's Veteran Coordinator with Swords to Plowshares, and also Lindsay Russo-Burnett, a former sergeant in the U.S. Army. Meg McLagan is with us by phone. Filmmaker made the film Lioness about the experiences of female soldiers in Iraq, which airs on KQED Channel 9 Thursday, November 13th at 10:30 in the evening. And we also spoke with Rainey Ruthig, a former staff sergeant in the U.S. Army. We're going to go to your calls here in just a moment. I ought to mention the fact, though, that in, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Meg McLagan, in countries, most other countries in the Western world, like the U.K. and Israel, where women serve, well, what's the role in combat?
Well, none of them allow women in combat units in those countries.
That was my assumption. They're allowed technically in Canada, but Canada is not involved in any kind of engagement in combat.
Yeah, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, I think. But in the UK, yeah, they're not. And in Israel, I think they experimented with this at some point in the past, and then have gone I think a bit away from that.
And Tia Christopher, we were talking a little bit about the fact that Patty Murray, Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, had put forward a bill to focus on female veterans at the Department of Veterans Affairs to facilitate especially sexual abuse assessment and post-traumatic stress disorder and gender-specific health concerns. It's pretty much been kind of held up, in fact. It's not going anywhere, at least now, for the present.
And it's not the first time this has happened with pro-women veteran legislation. The sad thing about Senator Murray's legislation, there were some really good components in there that would have really helped, such as child care at VA so that women have greater access to appointments, more oversight of the programs at the VA to make sure that there is equal health care for women veterans, even though the VA has been mandated of that. It's, you know, again, policy and practice is a really interesting issue. But yeah, there's some really, really important components in that legislation, and I'm really hoping that she takes another pass at it.
Well, we're going to go to our callers. And again, if you have something you'd like to contribute to this discussion, we do welcome your calls. It's toll-free 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum at kqed.org. Robert, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I was with the 870th Military Police Company out of Pittsburgh, California, and we had women gunners as gunners or Humvees. They did the exact same job we did. In fact, the exact same job I did. There were tower guards that would grab prisoners. They did the same job as men.
Okay, Robert, I'm sorry. Your line is terrible here. We can barely hear you. But I think the point is largely that, again, Lindsay Russo-Burnett, women were doing and are doing the same thing men were doing.
Absolutely. And one of the best examples is female medics. You know, they were routinely, again, you didn't have enough medics to go around, so they were routinely assigned to military police units who, the unit I served in, several of those MP units were engaged in offensive combat activities, and these women were serving as medics, and they routinely came under fire, and they were the first ones on the scene to treat these soldiers. And, you know, a lot of times this was the difference between life and death.
I should mention, in fact, talk about medics and treating soldiers. Tia Christopher, one of the things that I certainly learned from my relationship with Swords to Plowshares, and I'm seeing your dinner every year, is just to what extent more soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan are coming back with serious disabilities and wounded, largely because there's more medical technology now that can save them. I mean, more lives are being saved, but paradoxically, more people are coming back with terrible problems.
You can, if you, the public's welcome to go to our website where we've published one of our papers, Combat to Community, which goes over a lot of the risk factors for homelessness and substance abuse that, that we have, tabulated. And we, you know, with Source of Pashas, we've been treating these really serious issues since the 70s. And what we're finding with the Iraq vets is that it's escalating. And the point of the vets reaching homelessness is so much quicker.
In many cases, because of physical disabilities and because of wounds, yeah.
Right, and multiple deployments. Multiple deployments are a huge, huge risk factor for mental health concerns, for substance abuse, for homelessness.
More of your calls. Pam, join us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have to say I'm appalled at how I'm hearing our vets being treated. And I'm sure when they come home, they're overwhelmed with all kinds of things. Is there an organization that I could call to adopt or become an advocate for one soldier where I could help them through the process, make phone calls, follow through, and just help one person or one family through the process?
Well, that's a kind thought, especially on Veterans Day. Anecdotally, we should add here, and Tia or Lindsay, you can address this, that the VA care, at least here in the Bay Area, is discussed as a model for universal health care. I mean, they're really doing the job in many instances. Yeah,
absolutely. This is Lindsay. I have to tell you, when I moved from Tennessee to the Bay Area, I was actually lucky that I got great care there. And I discovered that the best way to get care is to go to the VA hospitals because they're usually affiliated with the university. And everyone told me when I came here, oh, it's great. San Francisco's got the best hospital. But in response to the caller, I'd have to do a little more research. But right off the top of my head, I can tell you, contact your local Disabled Veterans Association or Veterans of Foreign War or American Legion, because they have done wonderful work, especially when it comes to navigating the VA disability process and so forth. Like, they're wonderful. And I think that they're a lot of times not put into the limelight. But, you know, I got some great help from them when I was trying to go through the process to get my disability claims put through.
And like I said, Thursday night, as far as Source of Plowshares, every day is Veterans Day. But, Michael Blecker, St. Michael, as I call him, who's the founder and head of Source of Plowshares, was saying that here in San Francisco, things are so unique. You've got homeless veterans who are going to places like Treasure Island, you know, the Presidio. And that's wonderful. I mean, in terms of just places where you can reside, when you can find places for them to reside, these are pretty nice places to reside. Let me get more callers on. Phil from Burlingame. Morning.
Good morning. I don't think that there's any dispute that there are women that can do the job that men can do, and that there are men that can do the job that, you know, the standards can't do. But I think the basic reason for not having women in combat positions are two. Number one, survival of the people. You know, women birth babies, and men aren't that important. It just takes one guy to, you know, impregnate a large number of women. So, you know, repopulating your society. If you send your women into combat, it's hard. And then the second thing is a concern that in the event that women are captured or taken prisoner, that the opposing forces will sexually abuse them and not kill them or keep them as prisoners of war, according to Geneva Convention.
Well, let's get a response from our folks here in studio. Tia, Christopher, you want to respond to that? I mean, if women are in combat, it makes hurt the population type of argument, or won't be as fruitful to multiply, or something like that?
Wow. I guess to start, I'd like to say that 16,000 single mothers have already served in Iraq and have served valiantly. And the other part of that component of the caller's question or statement,
the vulnerability to sexual abuse.
The vulnerability of sexual abuse. I'd like to say, well, what about the sexual abuse soldier upon soldier, the rates of military sexual trauma where the perpetrators are fellow soldiers in uniform?
Well, Phil, thanks for the call, and we'll get more calls on. We'll go to Santa Rosa. Chuck, good morning.
How are you doing? I have a sister who just returned. She's been in the Army for 30 years. She turned 50 in Afghanistan, and for the year and a half, she was between Iraq and Afghanistan. And she told me 2 weeks ago that she's now officially unemployed and doesn't know what she's going to do. And I think really is a comment that of these 16,000 single women you just mentioned that have served, is they need to have an outreach for services just as much as the men do. And I know it goes without saying, but I've heard a lot on earlier shows this morning about veterans needing to get out and get services. And she, you know, is a mother of three. Her husband is serving currently over there. And her whole entire life has been the Army. And now she has nothing in that she doesn't need to go back and she doesn't have anywhere to go. And so she's kind of in this quandary of, well, do I go work for the post office now for the next 10 years till I retire, or what? So I guess it was just a comment really to really push the female veterans that, you know, the services are there and you need to look out for them. And I'm definitely going to tell her about your documentary to watch.
Well, it's an important comment. I'm glad you highlighted that fact, and thank you, Chuck. And let me go back to Megan McLagan, who's in New York with us, the filmmaker who made Lioness. There's some ironies in this because there are women who want to change this policy and advocate combat, but the fact is, I guess, that they can't.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a conversation that we all need to have as a society, and the Department of Defense has to take a look at the combat exclusion policy, and the Army has to look at the collocation policy and really look at revising it so that it matches the nature of the combat that the U.S. is engaged in Iraq and elsewhere. And then once that gets examined and revised, then these positions will be women will be able to get the kind of training that they need for the situations that they're finding themselves in. And until that gets revisited, you know, we're going to have this confusion.
Well, the film shows commanders pretty confident in the capacity of women to serve in combat missions. I was wondering, what kind of cooperation did you have from the military, since they're technically opposed to the idea of women in combat, and you kind of are an advocate of it?
Yeah, well, it took a lot of time and patience, but from the very beginning, we were very upfront about what our aims were with the film, which was really to try to convey the experiences of women who have been in combat in Iraq. And once we understood how to navigate the process and getting the permissions that we needed, it was surprisingly fine, and it was for us, it was really about building relationships with people. And we started our interviews. We sort of started at the top with the commanders of the folks you see in the film, and then once we went and talked with them and did our interviews with them, I think they felt comfortable in kind of letting everybody know that this sort of was a very serious project, that we were looking not to impose our own perspective one way or the other, but they were really interested in exploring these women's experiences and telling the story from their point of view. And I think that, you know, was not a problem for them.
Meg McLagan, again, is filmmaker who made the film Lioness, a film about the experiences of female soldiers in Iraq, that airs on KQED television this evening, Thursday evening, November 13th at 10:30. Lindsay Rousseau-Burnett, let me read a couple of emails from some of our listeners. This is Bruce, who says, notwithstanding the outstanding female soldiers with you this morning and their great contributions to our nation, they represent the highest achievers. Having retired after 32 years in the U.S. Army from private to command sergeant major in 2006 with combat tours in Vietnam and the Gulf War, I experienced firsthand the fact that an average male soldier can lift more weight, carry a greater load for greater distances, than can an average female soldier. This is not to denigrate female soldiers' contributions, but merely a fact. In combat, we rely on the average soldier to succeed, not super troopers.
Yeah, that's actually one of the main arguments outside the argument of, you know, women. No one wants to see a female soldier coming home in a casket. The idea that women can't physically stand up to the rigors of combat. I think that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have transformed what our traditional definition of combat is, especially in comparing it to Vietnam, and that the majority of your missions involve Humvees or helicopters. You know, the average female soldier is carrying just as much weight as the average male soldier. You know, it's not like they're giving women lighter body armor to carry because they're female. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And again, going back to the army, to the argument that there are just as many male soldiers who are not able to do those jobs as there are female soldiers. That's why I think it needs to be across the board. Everyone is equal. If you can do the job, you should be allowed to do the job. That's your decision and the decision of, you know, the training and so forth. It's not the decision of legislation to say that you cannot do the job because you may or may not be able to stand up to your male soldiers. I mean, put them in a test together and whoever can do it, male or female, should be allowed to do it, because at the end of the day, you want the best soldier out there who's going to protect your buddies, who's going to be able to do the mission regardless of gender.
Well, the listener was talking about average soldiers, and I was struck by the fact, I mentioned before bone stress fractures and some of the data that's come out of some of these organizations that stand behind the Pentagon on this say that, injuries, to all kinds of injuries, but bone stress fractures particularly, in non-combat training are two times as frequent in women as they are in men.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, from personal experience, I have compressed discs in my neck and my lower back, but I absolutely would not take back the work that I did. However, I think that can also be attributed to the fact that women are not receiving the same treatment. Everyone, you know, if you talk to any medical doctor, they'll tell you that bone stress fractures are higher in people who have not developed the muscle strength to be able to protect themselves and protect their bones. And so if women are afforded the same opportunity for that training, I think you'll see incidence of those stress fractures decreasing.
Here's a listener named Jason who writes, I find it an irony that there is such resistance to women serving in a combat role in the military, yet women in stories who have served in battle, stories of Amazons, Joan of Arc, etc., are idolized and given a huge reward among both women and men. I'd be curious about how this disconnect between the historical view of women warriors and current U.S. military policies affects women in the military. Lindsay, go ahead.
I guess I'll start, since we've kind of covered some of the physical aspects, I'll start with the issue of finances. Combat arms, when you enlist in the military in combat arms, you're afforded a much, much greater enlistment bonus. And when you re-enlist in the military, an infantry soldier who re-enlists in Iraq can get a re-enlistment bonus of up to $25,000. Those are not options for women, period. Women do not have that option available. And, you know, it's really doing a disservice to a lot of these women who join the military because they're trying to provide for their families. And the fact that they should be, put at a disadvantage because someone else says that they can't do a job when, in fact, you know, give them the option, give them the opportunity and see what happens.
I need to correct something. I misspoke before when I spoke about Canadian soldiers, because they are engaged in South Afghanistan with combat missions, and my apologies for that. It's a fact and something that just, even though my mother was Canadian, didn't occur to me. I mean, this is actually Remembrance Day in Canada, and there have been women who have died in Canada, so I didn't want to leave that standing there, obviously. Gus, join us. You're on. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael. Yes, Gus of San Jose. I am a proud listener sponsor of KQED. Thank you so much, gentlewomen, for your service, both during and especially after your time on the battlefield. I personally would like to see us add to our Constitution the Equal Rights Amendment as a preface. I think that, we need to level the playing field in general in society, and I agree with one of your guests that there's no reason why we shouldn't also equalize things on the battlefield. If women choose to serve and they are capable of doing what it takes, then, you know, welcome to the party. It ain't fun, but somebody's got to do it. So there we are. Beyond that, the reason I called to add my contribution is I was once a caregiver, as a person who actually looks after the physical needs of someone who is disabled in the case of this discussion, in the case of war. His name was Jerry. He's still alive, but he's severely disabled from his time in the Vietnam War. And I personally would agree from my time with him that there really ought to be just one person per returning vet who is completely responsible for what is going on in the way of his care or her care. And I think that's pretty much it. Other than that, just, the listening public could reference the movies with Demi Moore and Meg Ryan to get a hint as to what, women are up against. But Lioness, I'm sure I must see. So that'll do for now. I'll take the rest off.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Actually, when the Joint Chiefs of Staff was on with us on Forum, he was saying that In Israel, for example, commander is responsible ongoing after service for those who are under his or her command. Meg McLagan, getting back to your film, there's a moment in there where a woman named Rebecca is showing essentially all these armaments and all this weaponry and is, shall we say, to put it mildly, highly conversant with understanding exactly what she's showing there. And I mean, it kind of speaks for itself. It speaks volumes.
Yes, she was Rebecca Nava. She was a supply clerk, and we went out to film her at Fort Riley. We had filmed quite a bit with her when we went that final shoot, and she said, "You want to see the arms room?" And we said, "Yeah." So she took us in and took us through. And you know, at the end of that scene, she takes you through the night goggles and all the different kinds of guns, weapons, and then she says, you know, it's my lovely arms room with hardly anything in it. And we liked that because it was indeed true. It was not full, and there were clearly the base was very empty, and most people were deployed, and it was clear the sort of strain on the military. And Becky used to say, you know, only the broken people are left here at Fort Riley, the injured or the people who physically can't go, but we are stretched to capacity. And that sort of scene really signaled that for us in a way.
Well, there's this notion in the Iraq War, at least, that there's some kind of safety zone, that if you're, you know, on the base, you're in a different situation, but simply not the case. I mean, combat comes to those, well, who are everywhere, not just in the infantry. I think that's the message of your film, isn't it, really? One of the big messages of your film.
Yeah, definitely. Wherever women are, and as one of the panelists said earlier, you know, support troops, whether they're running convoys or whether they're doing this kind of specialized lioness work where they're going out on these night raids and doing this kind of work, they're absolutely all in harm's way. And in fact, Rainey's right that even the male support troops also could benefit from additional training because they also have particular specialties that they get trained for, and then they, in many cases, are getting called upon to do a lot of extra work in terms of combat work, and it's really a unique, you know, situation there.
Let's bring David on. David, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. You know, I've always felt the same sentiment about allowing qualified women in combat. But then I watched C-SPAN one morning, and there was this general, I don't recall the name, but he was speaking for the Army, and the issue came up. And he explained, here's how he said it. He said, imagine 10 people in a firefight in a combat mission with a mission objective. If one of them is a woman, 9 of them, the men will psychically and instinctually adopt the second mission of keeping the woman alive. And that could ruin the mission. And that's why women are not allowed in combat teams, because of her effect on the men. And that could change the mission objective.
Lindsay Rousseau-Burnett.
Yeah, gosh, I've heard that argument so many times, especially when I first got to my unit. It took me about a year of training with the infantry soldiers for them to be comfortable with me. So that was a big hurdle to get over. But I think that type of sentiment is directly born out of the fact that women are still kept separate from these, you know, combat armed troops. I completely believe that if women are training with these soldiers on a day-to-day basis, and they get to know each other, they get to understand, they see that this soldier is going to protect my back regardless of gender, that this soldier can do his or her job, I think that that's going to go away. But I think, you know, from, you know, a legislative side, from a hierarchy within the military, as long as you maintain this idea that women are separate yet supposedly equal, you're going to continue to have this bias. And until women are fully integrated into these types of jobs, you know, of course those sentiments are going to pursue. But, you know, what's the harm in trying? All you're going to do is increase the amount of people you have able to do a job. And with the military that's so stretched right now, you know, I only see positives coming out of this.
There is a concern, though, in the caller's voicing that opinion, that not only will men be protective perhaps toward women and therefore it will affect their efficacy in combat, but also that Well, there's a sexual component, and that somehow always gets into the equation that men are, it does, for example, with gays in the military as well, that men are going to be concerned about being debilitated by being made into sexual objects by other gay soldiers. That was the argument you kept hearing during that whole debate. And now it's the opposite, you know, that men will indeed sexualize women, and that will debilitate their performance somehow.
Yeah, I think the argument about gays in the military is very similar about the argument of women in the military. But again, you know, this might sound arrogant to you, but in my opinion, why is that my problem? Why should I have to be penalized because these other people can't get over the fact that I'm female? You know, the same thing happened with the segregated troops in World War II in Vietnam. You know, you had all black units, all Japanese units, because they felt that you couldn't integrate these people because it would destroy the integrity of the unit. Well, guess what? It's 2008 and you've got black and Latino and Japanese and all different races and nationalities serving alongside each other. And, you know, so far the military hasn't blown up.
Well, again, it's Veterans Day, and I want to extend thanks to all of those who have served this country, and including those who are with us today. And Tia Christopher, can you say some things in conclusion about how people can help veterans?
There's many ways you can definitely help veterans. You know, one, educate yourself on the issues facing this new generation of veterans and the issues they might be facing in transitioning from military life to civilian life. You know, don't ask them questions like, did you kill anybody in Iraq? Say things like, welcome home. You can go to the website coalitionforveterans.org. There's over 50 organizations that work with veterans in active duty on there that you can get involved with. A new book's coming out called Powder. Check it out. It's women veterans in their own voice. You know, we have a voice. Us women veterans in active duty have a voice. Listen to us.
Glad you had it this morning, and I thank you for your voices. I want to thank not only Tia Christopher, who's Women's Veteran Coordinator at Swords to Plowshares, but also Meg McLagan, filmmaker of Lioness, which you can see this Thursday night on Channel 9 at 10:30. And Lindsay Rousseau-Burnett, who is also with us in studio this morning, a former sergeant in the U.S. Army, featured in the film. Rainey Ruthrig was featured in the film, and she was with us earlier as well, a former staff sergeant, now an NCO. Thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. Coming up, an hour with the great John Updike. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Forum's engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.